benefits, and this is information that comes from both regional and national research. Rehabilitating a historic building allows 75% of its economic benefits to stay within the local community. Rehabilitating a historic building creates more jobs per dollar spent than new construction. And also, rehabilitating and maintaining a historic building conserves embodied energy and keeps valuable materials from going to the landfill. We think this project would help accomplish all three of those things here in the city of Portland. We know that Portland's design review fees, as you've heard, and the process is inconsistent with other jurisdictions around the state, and Portland often sets the tone for historic preservation efforts in the metro area and statewide. In the last couple of weeks, our organization has received calls from people in Beaverton and around the state who are concerned about design review fees, not because their community has them, but because this information about what's going on in Portland has gotten out around the state, and people are getting concerned for their own neighborhoods and historic districts. So in conclusion, the Historic Preservation League of Oregon supports the Historic Resource Code Improvement Project and is excited to continue working with the Coalition for Historic Resources and the great staff here in the city of Portland to further preservation objectives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor, can I just have a follow-up question? I was struck by one of your statistics, and I may have heard it incorrectly, but about the value, economic impact of preservation versus new construction. Could you state that again?
Sure. So historic preservation, actually, rehabilitating a historic building creates more jobs per dollar spent than new construction. It's also true for manufacturing and mining.
So that's, I'd like to know more about that. That runs somewhat counterintuitive to it because of another area of our work, which is affordable housing. And we always say that preservation is a cost per square foot is less than new construction when it comes to preserving existing buildings versus new construction. So I'd be interested in what the formula is on that. I mean, I'm sure it's right, but it's we save money when we preserve buildings that are affordable, but this is obviously with a historic overlay. This is a different formula. So I'm just...
I thought it was intuitive, and that is he's not talking about total cost. He's talking about the proportion of jobs to dollars spent, right?
Yeah.
So historic preservation involves more hands-on craftsmanship, and therefore there's more labor going into the project, right?
Than in new construction.
Yes.
Right. And I'd be happy to send your office information.
I'd be interested to see that, yeah.
You got it.
Sounds
yeah.
Interesting.
Makes sense to me as someone who owns a 1930 house and spends a lot of time with, say, a paint scraper. Thank you. Yeah, it's not in the historic district, but it's beautiful and it's old, and it needs a lot of work.
Next four are Wade Varner, Jason Kirsten, Carl Schaub, and Dean Giswold. They may have left. Go ahead with Nancy Oberschmidt and Susan Lindsay.
Dean, you may be intimidating other people, but come on up anyway. Welcome.
My first?
You are. Go ahead, please.
Okay. My name is Dean Giswold. I live at 2225 Northeast 15th in Irvington. This is a report from someone who is working in the trenches on a daily basis. I'm on the ICA board, and I've been the chair of the Land Use Committee for the last 5 years. I have personally reviewed every application that's been submitted to the Land Use Committee in terms of the Irving Historic District. They've been over 100. And I'm here today since its formation in October of 2010, about 2.5 years of experience in dealing with over 100 applications and a lot of people who tried to do restoration without first applying and then went through the code complaint process. I'm here today to make two recommendations, one in particular. I strongly recommend that you consider restoring local review appeal to the Type 1 reviews. In other words, the neighborhood or the applicant should have the right to appeal a staff decision in a Type 1 to the Landmarks Commission, which is currently the case with Type 2. There's an appeal right. And with the Type 3, there's a hearing in front of the Landmarks Commission. The Landmarks Commission, of course, is full of experts who know more about historic matters than I do. During the 2.5 years that we've been wrestling with this matter in Irvington, and I've been involved with all of those, we've had over 100 applications. We've had 2 appeals that the ICA has undertaken. And I'm just telling you that the first appeal was a disagreement with the staff interpretation of a particular historic district regulation. We appealed it to the commission. The commission sided with the neighborhood, thus changing that interpretation on an ongoing basis. Without local appeal, I'm not sure what our remedy would be, complain to the BDS, complain to the city council. Going to LUBA is not a sufficient remedy whatsoever. The second appeal involved a compromise solution agreed to by the staff. And by the way, there is a lot of discussion with the staff, and I have to commend the BDS staff highly educated on these issues and really citizen involved in working with the people and working with the neighborhoods and trying to reach a compromise solution, which in many cases were done. But in one case, it wasn't done. We appealed it. The commission sided with the neighborhood. There was one other appeal by an applicant who appealed to the commission, and the commission sided with the neighborhood. So 2 appeals, 100 cases. I don't think that the appeal process has been portrayed as costing a lot of money, costing a lot of staff time. That's not been our experience. And the neighborhood has developed a process to review these quickly. I call it the rapid response team, and we can do it in a week. And we can participate effectively in this process as we have in the others. And I think if you ask the folks at the BDS who I work with, that they consider us a partner, not a hindrance.
Thanks, Dean. Thank you very much.
I am Nancy Oberschmidt. I live at 1507 Southeast Alder. Buckman neighborhood for 35 years now. My house is on the historical register individually, and I took it through a long, arduous historic review process a few years back to replace a crumbling foundation. This allowed us to convert the house into a duplex, and my cousin now lives in the basement apartment, which is legal. You know, there's a lot in the neighborhood that are not. I volunteer for the Buckman Historic Association. I've worked a lot in the last 3 years on this process for historic district, for the part of Buckman that has the highest concentration of historic buildings. Without this protection, we feel like the character of Buckman would be lost. It is one of the oldest remaining historical residential neighborhoods in the city, and we feel it's threatened. Those that are opposed to the district cite the high design review fees and the cumbersome process, so I urge you to pass the amendments to the historic design review.
Thank you. Good morning. Just push the button in the center of the console there.
I can do that. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Susan Lindsay, and I'm chair of the Buckman Community Association. I want to echo what Nancy said. We recently had at our February BCA meeting, we had over 60 people there to talk specifically about the proposal to put a new National Historic District into a portion of residential Buckman. And what I have heard since this whole idea has come up that's been going on for a number of years, and it really was generated because of a great deal of concern that's happened with this close-in, low-income historic neighborhood that has no protections and has been kind of earmarked, as a lot of Southeast Portland has been, for a great deal of rapid density. Now, that backed off when the recession hit, but since the recession has, you know, eased up again, here we are again with towers starting to go up, as you well know, and because there is a great deal of inner Southeast Portland, a lot of streets that are recognized as this high transit streets, then we've got this additional issue of a great deal of density coming in and the houses being threatened with demolitions. And we did have a number of demolitions that have taken place. So the Neighborhood Association has not taken a position on the historic district. However, what we've tried to do is facilitate the process. And in facilitating the process, what we hear continuously from both sides, those proponents and those in opposition, is that they love Buckman. And what everybody is concerned about and has been concerned about is the process, the onerous process of design review, as well as the fees. And this feeling of the lack of equity that that wealthier neighborhoods are able to try to afford to be and put together a historic district, and that low-income districts cannot do that. So I'm here to say, first of all, thank you, Commissioner Salzman, for recognizing when we came to you last year and we said this is a great concern, and putting together and getting the help you did from Jay and from Tim and from and both all the staff at BDS and planning who came together to make these changes. We absolutely support the changes. We like the fact that there's going to be a review on the changes, on a yearly basis. And anything that we can do to get those fees down, and in particular to get them, waived in situations where we've got, working people, homeowners who are simply trying to improve their homes, would help. And I've made a commitment to the folks in Buckman on both sides of this issue that I will continue to speak up about this concern that we have about the fees and the process. People continuously, that's what they talk about, that they want to be able to make small changes and they want to love their houses and they simply can't afford it. So thank you for listening. I also have a letter that I'll submit into the record from Christine Yun. She is the president of the Buckman Historic Association and asked me to, she couldn't be here today because of work, and asked me to bring this letter in, and she also supports these changes. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mayor, I have a question for Susan. We've heard that the Buckman Community Association's residents are generally lower income than, say, Irvington. And I'm wondering if your community association would have the capacity to establish a rapid response like we just heard from Dean in Irvington.
Yeah, I loved listening to that.
It
well,
was great.
You know, to tell you the truth, we have to do rapid response for all sorts of issues. So far, it hasn't been anything related to historic design, but, oftentimes it has to do with, rapid response with crises that have come up in Buckman. So I think we would, but I was very interested in hearing that, and of course that's a lot because folks in Buckman were working people, So I mean, even the fact that I'm here today, I had to, don't tell anybody, and I know it's televised, but I had to step. I had to step
maybe
away
out of the bag there.
I had to step away from my day job just to be here.
Thank you for coming in and representing, Susan.
We really appreciate it. And potentially there might be some collaboration between the neighborhoods, perhaps since Irvington is one of our most involved neighborhoods regarding historic
resources. We would be happy to help any neighborhood who wants to learn how to do a rapid response team. or any other aspect.
Lending some expertise. Should Buckman have an application that they can't get to.
We've been working a little bit with Buckman. We'll do it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's all who signed up.
So maybe I know I have a question for staff. Others might as well. So if you could come back up, Tim and Diane. So the question I want to pose, I think, is the one that Dean's testimony raised, and that is I was wondering about this, if appeals are fairly rare, and at least in their experience in Irvington they have been, why is the appeal to LUBA a significant cost savings versus the local appeal, given their relative rarity? So what about that point?
Thank you. I wanted to talk. This is Tim Herron with the BDS. Thank you, Mayor. Welcome aboard again.
Yes.
Commissioner Novick, we got a chance to talk. It was nice to see you in person. Of course, the rest. I think the quick answer is with an appeal period added, it adds time to the review. It adds 2 weeks minimum to the process, and effectively would put us back into our type 2 category. So the strategy was twofold: not only to push towards a faster, slicker process that could potentially have a lower fee by virtue of its proportionally smaller scope of work, was also to have a timeline that was faster to get it out. So when you have a window restoration or a small-scale restoration, those types of work are usually turned around very fast. And by adding that additional timeline, we felt we could save time in getting that approval back out the door, which allows the permit to get out the door, which allows the work to get done faster. I think the only other add, and I would turn it on its head relative to the low number of appeals, is that they're low because we do it so well. So why add 2 weeks to the timeline for something I think we've nailed down very effectively? And from an issue of checks and balances, we meet, BDS staff meets with the Landmarks Commission yearly at our retreat. They'll also present to you their findings of the last year, the State of the City Preservation Report, which we've yet to schedule, which will be in April. And what we will do for certain is review, and already do, is reviews the commission doesn't see directly. And those are current type 2 reviews that are not appealed. And what we do is we talk about what staff has been doing, what we've heard in the community, and check in with them and well, relative to our review process and how well are we doing it. Did we miss something? Are we not following good preservation direction from the Landmarks Commission?
Well, I may not torture this too long now, but this is partially a refresher course for me. Is it that the new type 1 appeal is relying on the state statute safe harbor of clear and objective standards and therefore is not a quasi-judicial land use decision, or is it just a routing question of where these appeals are routed? Are they routed to the local appeal body, the Landmarks Commission, or are they routed to LUBA? Help me out.
I'd love to, and I'm so glad you asked, because where we first headed with this, where my goal was, is essentially to try and do with these small-scale reviews, have something like a historic confirmation letter, where it's just 2 weeks. It's a lowest fee possible. It's a memo from staff that says this meets the criteria. And we felt like we could get to something that was not discretionary, meaning clear and objective, and would not need noticing and could just be that fast-track, quick review, lower fee, lower timeline. On advice of counsel, our city attorney's counsel, it was clear that involves discretion. And because it involves discretion, and because we are in this great state of Oregon, and because we are trying to find a faster, slicker review process for these discretionary reviews in what is not just the largest historic district, particularly Irvington, is the clean that within a faster type 1 review, we do apply discretion. But it in these districts, given so many of them are in the same period of significance, there's not too many ways to do it right. And so that said, it still allows discretion. We are already moving towards building in some templates to allow these processes to meet our cost recovery concerns. So we're charging into this with a lot of excitement and being able to deliver a cost-effective process that's faster.
Tim, could you address the second part of Dean's comment, though? I mean, that was a great exchange, and I think I understood your thinking. Second part that he said, though, was without local appeal, he's not sure what the remedy would be. And so whether he comes here and takes a slot in our public session, goes to someone at BDS, what in fact would be the recourse if, in the unlikely event that it wasn't resolved at the staff level?
I'm glad you asked that, too, Commissioner, because it allows me to say something I've said at every hearing about the neighborhood associations is they're relentless. They have my phone number.
Good
they
way.
Have my email.
Say that in front of Susan Lindsay.
and I say that word is a positive word, and I say they are relentlessly active. Dean's comment about the fast response has code enforcement officers in our bureau scratching their heads on how quickly violations are coming in. So we are working that relationship together. If there's an opportunity to agree to disagree on issues, what we can do is the neighborhood could bend the ear of the Landmarks Commission. And I think when it comes to an issue or a concern that comes up directly, I think they hold on to that, and we address it at a future date.
Is this an issue that you would be able to track and report to us at the one-year review process
yeah.
so that if there is some experience here, mm-hmm. you could tell us how is that, in the unlikely event of a disagreement, how does that informal opt-out
yeah.
work?
Yeah, I mean, I would point out, you know, appeals are always tricky. As Dean mentioned, in Irvington, we've had 2 appeals. One of them was incredibly helpful for staff, and it had to deal with a rear addition, something you can't see from the right-of-way. It helped inform this process. It added discussion to I think help actually refine this document even better. The other one is just more complicated, and frankly, it is being appealed to LUBA, and it's very contentious. And it'll likely come back to Landmarks Commission because it was a mess, and sometimes that happens. So my point in stating that is the feedback loop we have from the Landmarks Commission and from the neighborhood is built into the process. By just eliminating the appeal does not mean we're going to take a different direction. It does not mean that we're not going to listen to the neighborhood if there are concerns. And it also doesn't mean we're not going to have an audience, which would be the Landmarks Commission, to kind of discuss these issues again. And in 1 year, when we come back before the Plains Sustainability Commission, I would imagine, and if this is adopted, we'll have a list of the type ones, and we're going to list out what was approved or how it was approved or denied, and have a discussion on maybe the sticky ones and see where we can make it better.
Tim, Commissioner. I mean, as the new guy, I was less enlightened than Commissioner Fish by your exchange with the mayor. I'm still, if you've got an appeal process that is rarely used, how does the continued existence of that process add time and resource constraints? Because it seems to me that if somebody decides not to appeal, then the fact that they would have time to appeal is irrelevant. They can go ahead and abide by your decision. I mean, is it that if there would be an appeal, what you write up in your decision would be different and more elaborate than if there is no appeal? What exactly adds time and difficulty?
Commissioner, that's a fair question, and I appreciate you being the new guy. I hope to work more often with you on this stuff, so please call me if you have questions. The short version is when there is an appeal period present, we can't not honor that appeal period, which means we cannot release building permits for the work that we approved, and that appeal period takes 2 weeks. So it really was a matter of, in these small-scale reviews, 2 weeks means something. Right now, our process is 6 to 8 weeks for a Type 2. That's what they go through now. If it was appealed, it would add a month.
Could the property owner just say, I'm not going to appeal, give me my permit now?
It's not just from the property owner. It could be from the neighborhood.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Anybody. That's, anybody. Right. Notice perimeter.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And again, what we're doing is not trying to take away something that the neighborhood has had a practice of exercising. And my point is saying, well, I think we're doing really well. It's been done twice out of 100 times. One of them was incredibly contentious with a number of issues and is an active issue. And the other one, it's a learning curve. And we learned. And we're doing better by it. And it informed this process. And it's why we narrowed the scope of this review to 150. It's why we added all these new terms for exemptions. It's why there's a plethora of support before you today and well-organized testimony. And it's why we feel very confident we can do it well. And if we drop the ball on one, I have no doubt we're going to hear about it. And we'll work that problem if it happens.
So we don't issue a permit until the end of the appeal period?
Correct.
Okay. The procedure for type 1 is going to go from 30 to 45 days to 14 to 21 days. Why is it? How is it being shortened? What is not?
Okay.
Why is that shorter?
Great. I may need a little help on this one, but essentially, it's 14 days shorter because there's no appeal period from the Type 2 process.
Say that again.
It's 14 days, 2 weeks shorter than the current Type 2, which all.
So I'm talking about the table on page 8.
Yes.
Says that the current existing Type 1, the days to the decision is 30 to 45.
Yes.
The revised Type 1 is 14 to 21. Why?
Why the difference?
Oh, check. That I've scratched my head ever since we changed the Type 1 several years ago, to extend the incompleteness review period from what we typically do is 14 days to 21 days. That means staff has 21 days to review an application before they need to send out a public notice. After that, the public notice is 30 days. And I think that generally gets us up to those minimums. And then at the end of the public notice, a decision can be issued right away. And an appeal, no local appeal, would go to LUBA.
Right.
So where we've shortened that is in the public response period, to which I'm glad to say the neighbors mentioned the rapid response system is
right.
Working with that. And we've also shortened the completeness review window for that. To be honest, I always scratch my head on why they were so long. But now that we've defined the scope of this new Type 1 to be 150 square feet or less, they are very small-scale issues. It's in historic districts where As I mentioned, there's really not too many ways to do it right. So the answers are clear, at least in our minds, and we're very convincing and educative when we talk with homeowners that need to understand why it needs to be one way or another. And that's how we compress that timeline.
So, but this is just for historic review, right?
Correct.
So why are you calling the existing type procedure 1X and the new type procedure 1?
Good question. The existing type 1, which will become a 1X, goes above and beyond just
historic reviews. Isn't that going to be confusing for type 1s in other kinds of land use reviews?
That's a fair question. We've scratched our head on it internally and how to deal with it. There may be an overlap in the first part where it may be, but we feel like because the original type 1 will just simply have an X added to it, changing its typology is consistent.
I understand that, but for other like environmental reviews that are type 1, that'll be a type 1, not a type 1X.
For new environmental reviews, it'll be a 1X, and we will reach out and let people know.
So this is changing it for all type 1s?
For original type 1s, right.
So are we changing the timelines for all type 1 reviews, including environmental reviews?
No. No, they stay the same.
So you're going to change the name of all type 1 reviews in other. Why change all the others rather than having a 1X for this one?
The process is, the way our hierarchy of our code is it's type, leaving X's out of it. There's type 1, there's type 2, there's type 3, there's type 4. We have already a type 2X, and it is longer than the type 2 process, but it is shorter than the type 3. So the X is an extension of a review. So by creating a new, shorter review process, it's shorter than the existing one.
I think that's going to be confusing in other situations, so maybe we can have some discussion on that.
Sure.
Minor detail, of course. The other question is, does the Landmarks Commission have a public comment period at the beginning or end or sometime during every Landmarks Commission hearing?
If it's before Landmarks, yes, absolutely.
No.
At every meeting that the Landmarks Commission meets at, do they have an open comment period from the public?
They have not typically done that, but they certainly can, and it's certainly at their discretion to open that door.
Well, I would suggest that since there isn't a formal appeal mm-hmm. to them, because otherwise the appeal is, as Commissioner Fish and the mayor pointed out, it's going to be to the commissioner in charge,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, might work well in some instances, but there's also going to be a public perception mm-hmm. that the commissioner in charge is putting pressure one way or the other on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm concerned about there being some route for getting an issue like this, which is going to be approved in 21 days max,
mm-hmm.
in front of the commission in a timely manner for them to run it up the flagpole from their perspective rather than from multiple emails to the member of the council who is assigned to be the commissioner in charge of BDS. So that would make me more comfortable if the Landmarks Commission could add that to their procedures.
That doesn't have to be put into the code, but I think it's a good suggestion. I mean, I mm-hmm. hear Dean's, I think I hear the underlying concern, and that is going to LUBA is the nuclear option. It's expensive. You know, there's no free right of appeal as there are for neighborhood associations and city process. So there has to be a door that the neighborhoods can go through to say this isn't working, and this mm-hmm. case illustrates it. And I mm-hmm. think that at least if that door was there, even if it wasn't case specific,
mm-hmm.
it would assure that we're looking at quality control on this from the beginning.
Yeah, it absolutely. I mean, the commission meets twice a month. Sometimes they have a less than busy schedule. This will obviously or potentially add to the schedule. I think it would be interesting, though, because whether or not we would need to notice or if it was a public hearing on a type 1 case. So I think that's
part
of it.
You can add a public comment period, okay. I think, without okay. having to trigger the whole land use review process. So.
Great. Yep. Cool. I couldn't see her nodding out of my back of my head.
She's nodding. Yes.
Great. Excellent.
Record show.
And then my final comment while you're all three here is that the public involvement briefing in the code packet is absolutely exemplary. If and when I'm assigned bureaus in May, this will be, I thought perhaps Diane was responsible for it. I'll direct my bureaus to make this a template. And I particularly like not only that you put the dates of who you met with, but also how many people participated at each of those. So thank you very much. And the other piece that I liked is that you gave details about what was changed in response to the public comment. And from my looking through it, it seems like you hit every single stakeholder group that you could think of. So thank you very much.
So I had a question about the fees.
Mm-hmm.
I think I guess two questions. Is there any reason why we can't get a new fee in place by the scheduled effective date for this ordinance of May 1st? And secondly, can the fee be more like $300 and $350 rather than, I think it was $500 being proposed now?
That's a good question for those above my pay grade. However, that said, when Paul kind of nubbed me as he's walking out, I know that's what we're targeting for. I believe we're going to be back before you in a couple weeks to look at fees and look at lowering that.
To get the fees in place.
Absolutely. And I would say shooting for half of that is the minimum we're shooting for. And that's why I also mentioned we are already gearing up internally with templates so that we could hit a cost recovery as low as possible.
Just to be clear, the new fee would be in place at the effective date of the new regulations.
Good.
Yep. Which is May 1st.
May 1st.
Right. Yeah. Thanks.
Other questions? If not, again, we're going to vote on this. Is going to come back for second reading, but there might be some comments at this point from council members. Like to make them. Certainly, since everyone's sounding a little shy, I'll start out. Just want to compliment again this process that's been thoughtful and collaborative and swift, and that's a great combination and hard to achieve. So credit for good work done by everybody from commissioner that led the effort to all of you that did it. It certainly is a model, and I'm thinking about the work that's underway right now on parking requirements for infill apartment projects. That same standard, I think, is holding in this case from being collaborative, moving quickly. So like the model, as Susan and Paul suggested, let's keep using it. Just a personal comment, not a couple of anecdotes not involving a paint scraper. I spent the last 10 years working all over the country, and then I spent the last year and a half running for this office. And a couple of combinations from that, two profound impressions, three, actually. One is other cities have historic districts. You know, there's the avenues in Salt Lake City, and there's over the Rhine in Cincinnati, and there's Country Club Village in Kansas City. And those are nice historic districts. But thanks to the uniqueness of Portland and our history in the decades before and after the 1905 Columbia Exposition was this amazing flowering of high-quality residential construction over a huge area. And nobody's got this. I mean, nobody's got half of this in the rest of the country. And, of course, you know, walking door to door running for office is a great way to check up on the condition of a lot of those houses. And I had a very strong impression over the last year that people really are putting a lot of effort and sweat equity and money into putting those great old buildings in better condition. And that's certainly heartening. And then third, nobody else has got this civic infrastructure of people that care and volunteer their time, whether it's as a member of a commission or as a member of a coalition, that so often bring us good public policy in Portland. So those three experiences really highlighted what we've got going for us here, that we do have this amazing resource, that we rely on private property owners to take care of it for us, therefore the need to give them an easy path to do so, and that we've got a lot of activists that have advanced the cause. So just really impressed by this whole piece of work. Other comments?
I would just, once again, just want to thank everybody. This is a model work of getting something done quickly and making the product something that's easier and more efficient, at the same time providing adequate protections for our historic resources. I forgot to single out, in all my thank yous, I want to thank Diane and all the other staff besides just Jay and Tim, but most of all, I want to recognize Matt Grum of my office, the man behind the curtain in my office. So he really helped shepherd this whole thing through and to the point where it's here today. And I do want to just add that, you know, when I met with Susan and Paul originally to talk about this and they came back with this schedule of actually having something done this quickly, I was a little skeptical, and I always wondered, okay, that February date, are we really going to meet that? And here we are, what is it, February 27th. So you got it in on time, and it's a good example and good work. So thanks.
I do have one more comment since you had some more time to look through things, or a question concern. In the proposed code changes for the Type 1 and Type 1X, you're proposing to strike the date and time will be at least 30 days from the mailing of the notice and 5 days before the decision must be rendered for all Type 1 decisions, not just for Type not just for historic review. So we hear for this type of one, there's a well-organized, this is on page 56 of the proposed code amendments. So for this particular issue, there are well-organized neighborhood groups who can respond within a week, but for type 1 environmental reviews, for example, I don't think there are. So I'm wondering and concerned about that particular amendment.
Take some further look at that in the intervening week here.
Please. Because it might be that it would be better to have a type 1H specifically for these historic reviews rather than for trying to, because we haven't noticed that we're changing the process for all type 1s.
Well, keep in mind that this is what's required to be in the notice, not what the notice requirements are. So this is what the notice that gets mailed must contain.
But it's changing whatever the requirements are for all type 1s, not just for historic review.
Is that right?
I don't believe so.
Well, that's,
I'm looking at type 1,
yeah.
And it should be the identical language that was there before.
Well, we'll look into that, but it, yeah. Unless we can get that clarified, I think there might need to be an amendment on that.
Let's look at that and see. Yeah, I hear your point.
Thank you. And I do appreciate all the good work that's happened with the community members, the Planning Commission, the Landmarks Commission, the Development Review Advisory Committee reviewed it. There's certainly, as I said, you've gone to all the stakeholder groups, and I greatly appreciate the good work.
I just want to say that it's been very encouraging as a private citizen over most of the past year and a half or so to watch this issue bubble up as a controversial issue and then see people work towards a resolution. And I want to second what I think was the mayor's implicit suggestion that some of the same people need to work on the apartment buildings without parking issue and come to as, you know, the consensus-driven resolution as you have on this one.
Good. Well, this will move to second reading. Given this discussion, I think that's fair to predict that it might pass, but we will, in the meantime, look at this point that Commissioner Fritz has rightly raised, and if there's a need to amend, do so, but we won't change the schedule. So thank you very much. Moves to second reading.
Thank you.
All right. We have two more remaining regular agenda items, I think, Carla.
Item 177, declare intent to initiate local improvement district formation proceedings to construct street, sidewalk, and stormwater improvements in the Northeast 52nd Avenue and Alberta Street Local Improvement District.
Morning, Andrew. How are you?
Good morning, Council members. I'm Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator. This is my first LID item of 2013, and it's especially a privilege to have you, Mayor Hales, and you, Commissioner Novick, consider this agenda item. Carla has just set up the presentation here. I just have two quick slides to show you. So Parks is planning to build a new park facility at 52nd and Alberta, and I understand that that park does not yet have a name. But the Bureau of Transportation and the Bureau of Parks have been coordinating the infrastructure improvements around this new park to be built next year. And what we're planning to do is to coordinate very closely so that when Parks is designing the park improvements, Transportation is designing the street improvements next to the park. So in the past couple of years, I've had two street projects near Parks where the parks were both improved with Portland Development Commission funding, and then Transportation came in a couple years later to build street improvements, and we've had to tear out some of the irrigation, the lighting, new street trees, et cetera. So what we're really trying to do here is just to work more smartly and coordinate the design of the respective park and street improvements to avoid those tear-out costs. And just to give you an example, we're wrapping up a street project near Raymond Park in the Powellhurst-Gilbert neighborhood. And we budgeted about over $80,000 to tear out irrigation, landscaping, street trees, and then move everything back so that we could get the street frontage improvements in. So we're just trying to work more smartly here. Now, this is a continuation, in effect, of what Council approved 3 weeks ago on February 6th when you approved the master plan for the Werben property, and Council gave its approval to the scope of the park improvement. So a fair amount of outreach done by the Parks Bureau on the development of the new park, and the street improvements that we're planning are fully consistent with the outreach done. So specifically, what transportation is planning is to widen the pavement by 5 feet on both 52nd and Alberta to provide for off-street parking, because that park will not have any off-street parking facility. There will not be a parking lot for the park. And from my experience, my colleagues in parks do a very good job of designing parks. They become very attractive. As much as we want everybody to walk or bike to parks, there's always a certain number of people driving who need a place to park. So by widening the street, we will provide on-street parking for people coming to the park. And we are also planning a much more robust stormwater drainage system than what exists now. And then lastly, but certainly not leastly, we're planning to build sidewalks along the entirety of the park frontage, because we want to have a much safer route for people to walk to Rigler School, which is just a few blocks away. So I'm going to hand out copies of the two slides that I'm showing you here to Carla, and I have a couple emails I just wanted to hand out as well. So now that we Peabot and Parks have already entered into an agreement to do the street frontage improvements, then the question is, do we want to give property owners nearby the option, if they wish to voluntarily, to also improve their frontage as well? And I was contacted by a resident who lives across the street from Holly Farm Park in Southwest Portland, and he had complained about gravel along his frontage, and his comment to me was, gee, you know, I really like the park across the street, did a great job on the street improvement, but nobody ever came to me and gave me the option of improving my frontage at the same time. So that was really what, that in combination with the two other projects that I've collaborated with Parks on, just gave me the idea of offering up a voluntary LID where if the folks across the street also wanted to improve their frontage, they could do that. So just to be really clear, we're not here to obligate anybody to be part of the LID who doesn't want to be part of the LID. So if council approves this, we go through the design process. We will be inviting all of the neighborhood residents to the street design meeting so we can show them what we're planning to build, even if they're not part of the LID, even if they're not paying for it. My experience on a street that I should be paving in the next couple of weeks near Sacagawea Park is property owners come to me during the design process. They see what we have planned. They like what we have planned. And in some cases, they say, I'd like you to go ahead and take care of my frontage at the same time. So without the LID mechanism, I have no way to accommodate that request. And then the other email that I just wanted to distribute out to you here is from a neighbor who lives close to this future park. She expressed some real concerns to me about stormwater drainage, and she's very pleased that the scope of this project includes a more robust stormwater solution. So I'll hand that out to Carla. And I think that pretty much recaps it all. I've got Travis Rubal here from the Parks Bureau if you have any specific questions about the park improvements, which this resolution does not address. If council does approve this, we'll be back in 4 weeks to formally approve the ordinance to form the LID. And as mentioned, that ordinance will then give the LID administrator, myself, the authority to negotiate agreements with property owners who may wish to opt in to the improvements as we go through design. And then finally, Park did a lot of outreach during the design of the project, and they had very clear feedback from the neighborhood that they wanted sidewalks along the street frontage to provide that safe route to Rigler Elementary School. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. By the way, here's a slide of what the new park is going to look like. That'll be Travis's job to make sure that gets designed and built.
Just to clarify, Andrew, if the process moves forward as you just described and a property owner does not want to participate in the LID, they are not in danger of being involuntarily added to the LID and assessed, right?
That's correct. So the default, everybody will be, in effect, part of the LID and be assessed, but they will be, in effect, zero assessed. So when we close out the LID, if they have not opted in, they get a bill for zero. There's nothing for them to pay. The only way that they pay anything is if they affirmatively sign up for the LID.
But would they get the frontage improvements?
they would not get their frontage improvement. So we would widen the street and add the on-street parking on the park side, but we would not widen the street on the other side or add additional stormwater drainage or additional pavement widening or a sidewalk.
I really appreciate that you're giving the option for this. Under the LID rules, if the majority of the property owners want in, then they're in, whether they like it or not. Here, Parks by itself is the majority property owner. Are you going to consider a process where if the majority of the rest want in, then everybody has to be in?
Well, we could do that, in which case, I mean, if we're looking at bringing anybody in who doesn't want to be in, then I would bring that back to council, because obviously I wouldn't have the administrative authority to just do that. My sense of this is it would be kind of like the way the development review process happens, where if somebody's remodeling their house or doing something, then they may have a requirement to do their frontage improvement, in which case the LID could be a really good option for them. And by the way, one of the community folks with whom I spoke was thinking about redeveloping her property, so this might be a real good example of how she might opt in. But no, the intent would not to be to force the majority of the folks on the other side of the street to be part of the LID if they didn't want to.
So one property owner could say no, and then all of that side of the street would not get done?
We would only build the frontage for those property owners who wanted to opt in. So keep in mind that we're rebuilding the street over on the park side, so it would just simply be a matter of extending the pavement, adding the curb, adding the drainage on the other side. So it is a piecemeal approach. We would only build the frontage for those who opted in.
So you might have one house with the proper frontage and one not, and then another one
yes.
with? Wow. Okay.
It's really a policy question, but we're just trying to avoid forcing anybody into it. And we might, for example, have one property owner that has a real drainage issue that they want to have us deal with, and maybe the person next door doesn't have so much of a drainage issue. So.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to you bringing it back and getting some public homework.
And on a final note, I would just say we're really trying to balance the expenditure of park SDC funds, because it's not uncommon for the neighborhood to say, gee, we'd really like you to expand this project. We just simply need to have a way to pay for it. And it wasn't reasonable to ask Parks to not only build their frontage, but then also deal with all the infrastructure deficiencies in the neighborhood. So,
you're asking us to adopt this resolution, so to give you the green light to move forward?
Yes, and there will be another ordinance coming back to you in 4 weeks that will formally do that by ordinance. So.
The resolution today.
It's really been a pleasure to be able to coordinate with Parks on this and avoid and work more smartly on the joint project.
May I move the resolution?
Second. Okay, then let's take a roll call on the resolution, please.
And no one signed up to testify. Fritz?
Well, thank you for bringing this forward, Andrew, and indeed, if any of the residents do want to see an example of a street that isn't necessarily optimal for the current residents, it would be Southwest Comus by the Holly Farm Park. I do think I would be open to looking at a modification whereby if the vast majority want to do it, that you do the whole thing. I think it would be really difficult to engineer a partial stormwater system, for example, or putting some curbs in some places and not in others would then create even more problems for the property owner, which I know you're aware of. So I appreciate this new process, recognizing that the city is the majority property owner, and I'll look forward to having the hearing. Aye.
Fish?
Andrew, thank you. Earlier we saw a wonderful example of collaboration between planning and the Bureau of Development Services. I'm pleased that this, I think, reflects good solid collaboration between parks and transportation. And I also really appreciate your looking upstream and thinking creatively about how to use this tool. I am, you know, sort of superficially inclined towards Commissioner Fritz's view about looking at this more holistically, but I'm also reminded that this is an underserved area with a population that has waited a long time to have their first park, and I would be loath to impose additional costs as a condition of getting the park they've waited a long time for. And I think the voluntary nature here is keeping faith with what we're trying to do more generally in the neighborhood. But thank you for your good work. Aye.
Saltzman.
Good work. Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
The experimentation should continue. Thank you. Aye. Okay. And we have one more item on the calendar, an ordinance.
Item 178, authorize water revenue bonds to refund outstanding bonds and finance water system capital improvements.
Good morning. Who's on first, Jonas?
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. Jonas Beery, the city's debt manager. I'm going to provide just a brief summary of the ordinance. This non-emergency ordinance authorizes water bonds that accomplishes two objectives. First, the ordinance authorizes issuance of water bonds that will finance up to $161.5 million of expenditures of the Water Bureau Capital Improvement Program over the next 18 months. Water Bureau staff is here to talk about that in a minute. The portion of the bonds for the CIP projects will mature over no more than 25 years. Will be payable from revenues of the water system and will increase annual debt expenditures by approximately $10.5 million a year, as is reflected in the current requested budget. Second objective is the ordinance authorizes approximately refunding of approximately $100 million of outstanding water revenue bonds. The refunding reduces the interest rate on those bonds and also allows us to reduce the size of the legally required debt reserve by revising the master declaration for water revenue bonds. The refunding results in a total reduction to debt service of sort of minimum $6 to $6.5 million. I mentioned the master declaration, and I want to just touch on that for just a moment. A complete draft of the master declaration is included as Exhibit A to the ordinance. The declaration details the specific requirements related to this series of bonds and future series of second lien bonds. It includes standard provisions, such as a requirement to produce annual revenues sufficient to pay the debt and to meet coverage requirements, financial tests that must be met before additional bonds can be issued. It also includes a number of administrative kind of updates. I just want to provide some comfort to you that it's a big document. It is materially consistent, with the exception of the reduction to the reserve, with the water revenue bond declaration that we've been operating under for many years. I'd be happy to answer questions about the financing, but I think it maybe makes sense to have the Water Bureau Director talk a little bit.
Could you just explain what a second lien bond is?
Sure. Good question. So second lien means we also have outstanding first lien bonds, which means the first use of net revenues is pledged to pay that first lien bond. Mm-hmm. Second lien means this is a secondary, the secondary pledge. So we first pay the first lien, then we pay the second lien, and then the revenues that are left over fall out for other purposes.
But it's all Water Bureau water revenue. There's no general fund
correct
backstop
yes
or anything like that.
Correct.
Okay.
And does the $161.5 million in the new bond issuance reflect $6 to $6.5 million less because of the refinancing?
So the $161 million is just the proceeds that are going to just the new money portion. So when we issue the bonds, it'll be $160 for the new money plus $100 for the refunding.
But what happens, again, to that $6.6.5 million that we're saving on the previous bonds? Why doesn't – has that reduced the amount that we're now going out for new debt?
To the extent that the reserve is reduced, so for example, if we had the sort of full reserve requirement that we've had historically, that would require about $12 million of additional funding. The way this is structured with a lesser reserve, it's only about $6 million, so it does reflect that reduction. The savings that I've talked about as a result of the refunding is really savings on the annual payments, and the $161 reflects the par amount. The amount we're borrowing, whereas the payments are so if we think about the $10.5 million annual over 25 years, the 6.5 in aggregate would be a reduction on that to that annual amount. So slice, so let's say it's $250,000 a year less that we'll be paying for the 25-year term of the bonds.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Port and Water Bureau, and with me is Cecilia Hoon. She is the finance director for the Water Bureau. Usually at this point we would describe what we're planning on doing with the revenue, with the proceeds of this bond. I have shared with your staffs what our current plan is for the use of these 2013 revenue bonds. They will be used primarily for the four big projects that are currently under construction now that you have approved over the last several years. The Interstate Facility Project, the Bull Run Dam 2 Tower Project, Powell Butte 2, and Kelly Butte. And in addition, they also fund over the next 18 months the other portions of our CIP. And they're in the mains program, the pumps and tanks program, the meters, services, and hydrants program, and then two standalone projects, the Headworks Flow Meters program, or the Headworks Flow Meters project, and the ECC, the Emergency Coordination Center. Mains vary from very large project mains to very small one block long type of mains. Some are done by our crews, Water Bureau crews, those that are under $125,000. Some are done, those that are above $125,000 are done by contractors. We expect to do about 50 distribution mains over the next fiscal year. Some of the larger ones that we have planned for this coming fiscal year include the Bertha Service Area Improvements, the Raymond Tank Supply Improvements, the Division Street Piping, and then the Carolina Pump Main Extension, Phase 2. On the pump stations and tanks, Fulton Pump Station, which we've talked about a number of times, and which is just at about 90% design and will be looking at starting construction in this coming fiscal year. The Forest Park Low Tank, which is currently under construction. And then the meter services and hydrants. We replace about 5,000 small meters, the sort of meters that serve our homes, about 30 large meters. They can be as big as this table. And then service renewals. We replace or renew about, we did about 1,500 last year. We've done about 700 this year so far. And hydrants. Last year we did about 100. We have 150 done so far. We'll be doing that about that much next year. And then we've talked, I think the last time when I was here last week about our budget, I talked a little bit about the ECC and the Headwork Flow Meter projects. Be glad to answer questions about any of those.
David, since you referred to the budget presentation, the question I had is, to the extent the council is going through a budget process, which is going to lead to a rate, and that rate may cause the Bureau to defer or delay any of the capital improvement projects in the pipeline, would a decision that we make over the next few months have an impact on the authority you're seeking from us today?
No. What it would mean is that it might push out our next bond sale. For instance, we're proposing to sell bonds, $173 million in bonds, to produce the $161 million that Jonas is talking about in March. Then we anticipate doing an August 2014 sale. If some of the CIP projects that we are proposing in this coming fiscal year and the out years are projects that the council says, let's hold off, let's defer those, let's push those out, what that would mean is we would delay our bond sale in 2014.
Would that come back to us for a further discussion, or how does that work?
Would which come back to you?
Any deferral of a bond application?
Well, we're not going to, we don't come to you for authority to sell bonds until we're at the point where the we need the revenues. So the question that I think for that
you're free to
you're asking.
You're free to reframe the question, Counselor.
The question that I believe you're asking
is. That's the question I should have asked, and then would you give me the answer that is responsive, please?
You will have the ability to, you are required to weigh in on our budget.
Right.
And on our CIP, and then on individual projects over the course of the next year, we'll be coming to you with contracts, that sort of thing, to move forward on actual construction of contracts. So this is that time of year where you, as the executive board of the City of Portland, are telling bureaus such as mine, which projects that you want us to move forward on, which projects that you have questions about, and what's the impact on the rates, and how are we going to pay for those over the next several years.
We would have to approve the 2014 bond sale, just like you're here today for this one.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, okay. The bond sale that we're asking you to.
Thank you. Thank
you. The bond sale that
a lot of help today. The witness, colleague, Commissioner Fritz, could you please jump in here?
The bond sale that we're going to be asking you to vote on next week funds not only part of this fiscal year that we're in, so projects that you already approved, projects for the next fiscal year and a little bit of the fiscal year after. But the individual projects, this is how we're paying for the